So, ladies and gentlemen, it's my great pleasure to introduce my co-panelists this evening, my guests here at the Whitney Biennial Special Review Panel. To my right, your left, Bill Berkson, returning to the review panel for his second appearance, is a poet and art writer. He's Professor Emeritus at the San Francisco Art Institute. He's a corresponding editor at Art in America and serves as poetry editor at Art Critical magazine. His most recent book of art writings for The Ordinary Artist was published last year. Karen Wilkin, who, like Bill, is making her second appearance here on our panel, publishes her criticism at The Wall Street Journal, The New Criterion, Art in America, and The Hudson Review, where she is a contributing editor. She is also a prolific author and curator, whose most recent project is the exhibition American Vanguards, Graham Davis Gorky, de Kooning and Their Circle, which she co-curated at the Neuberger and which travels extensively thereafter. And Will Heinrich is art critic for the New York Observer. He is also a novelist, author of The King's Evil, published by Scribner in 2003, which won a Penn Robert Bingham Fellowship Award in 2004. So, ladies and gentlemen, a distinguished panel, please welcome them. So, panelists, I mentioned in my entirely neutral introductory remarks how, in a way, the Whitney is a successor to those great 18th, 19th century institutions, the academies and salons, such as the one upstairs. Is that a historically accurate, fair remark, do you feel? And do you feel it is in any way helpful to giving you a grounding on what you should be doing as somebody attending the Whitney Biennial? Anybody like to jump in on that issue? Karen?
Well, the 18th century salons people went to as much to make fun of as to enjoy, so I think the Whitney is certainly fulfilling that original function. The difference is that believe it or not, the 18th century salons were obviously much more inclusive. I mean, what was it? You know, 2,500 works hung cheek by jowl. If you read Diderot's reports on the salons for his private newsletter, it's like, you know, oh God, I've got to write about this artist. You know, he doggedly goes on. I have absolutely nothing to say about him. It's too depressing. You know, so he goes on to the next. At least we don't have to do that.
Yes, we managed to whittle it down to 20 out of already a fairly short list, yeah. And nobody is groaning that we are being too streamlined, too exclusive, exclusionary. But Bill, what's your take on the Whitney? Is it an institution that
place?
The biennial. Is it something you think, the biennial at last? Responsible curators have scoured the land north at all points on the compass, and here is people I trust who are taking the temperature on visual culture today in America, or is it, the Whitney again?
You know, I grew up when it was the annuals, and then it seemed to be a little more of taking the temperature of mostly New York. So that's been cast aside or expanded. And, you know, it's just, let's forget about the show and talk about the artists, because nobody wins with that show. I mean, I can't remember, even though now you see there are two reputable or responsible or even excellent critics in New York who have written glowing reviews of this show, then everybody who saw it up to today that I talked to, like the word on the street, says, "Oh, it's awful." So you know, how do you figure that? I remember when Jeff Koons had a show in New York sometime in the late '80s, and all of the critics responsibly panned the show, and the word on the street was everybody loved it.
So, yes, That may well be the crisis of criticism.
I mean, I myself have probably reversed myself 10 times in the last 10 hours over the show. I mean, at one point yesterday, I was gnashing my teeth about it, and I said to the person I went through the show with, why is it that a show like this can make you so angry? I don't understand. Why should anybody's art? It's not the art that makes you angry. It's the curating that makes you angry. And you don't blame the artist somehow, but it's sort of how could they? You know, I don't think that, for instance, there's anything. My impression is that there is nothing offensive. Well, the dance last night was offensive. but there's nothing offensive in the galleries otherwise. The dance was offensive because it was trite.
Well,
the lewdness was trite.
Yes. We'll certainly... good. I think we might have a little disagreement. We always like that on the review panel.
Yum.
But Will... I wouldn't like to guess which of us is youngest, but one of us is probably one of this. Somebody here must be the youngest. But
I think
Will,
it's polite to say Karen.
What is your expectation of a biennial? Do you go at it with relish or do you go at it with dread?
I had very low expectations, I think, and I think that's why I kind of liked it. But I think the people who disliked it. Probably want from it something impossible. You know, I think when you're any large group show, you're trying to find a balance between kind of imposing a unitary decorative scheme that overwhelms the individual pieces of art you put in, or having no vision at all. And what I liked about this was that there seemed to be an even balance, a coherent idea, but not such as to prevent me from looking at the individual work. So I think I agree with Bill that I would rather talk about the work. The show itself or the institution is kind of a circus. You know, it's a money-making operation that that's fine. That is what it is. But I don't have a lot to say about it as a phenomenon. I'd rather talk about the art.
I mean, historically, if you asked about the connection with the Salons, if you just look at the Whitney criticism from when it was the annual, it used to alternate 1 year painting, 1 year sculpture and drawings. And I don't think there's ever been a Whitney show that wasn't discussed in terms of how it failed to do what it was supposed to do, which was represent whatever, and it's consistent. It's clearly an impossible event.
Yes. I felt that in a way that in earlier years, you, as you say, Karen, it alternated between painting 1 year or sculpture the next or other kind of medium divisions.
That was when it was the annual.
Right, exactly.
That's how it worked. And that hasn't been the annual for
donkey's years. In fact, it did start as a biennial, then it became an annual, then it went back to being a biennial. But what I've noticed, however, in my shorter tenure in New York than some others here, is that the biennial itself kind of alternates. It's as if one biennial is very capricious, self-indulgent, and sort of irresponsible, and then it's followed 2 years later by a rather dour and sour kind of survey of what's happening in America. And I guess I also get the sense that it would be difficult enough to say what's going on in New York, but it becomes exponentially more difficult when you do have to scour the land, as it were, and put together a national consensus. And what do we make of the fact, however, that in quite a number of instances, this year's selectors seem to have really been anxious to subvert the essential remit of the Whitney, which is to be the Museum of American Art, insisting on including collectives where out of four artists, one was born in America and now lives in Europe, and that therefore makes those four people eligible, or art and language have works that are dotted around the place, mostly on the fifth floor, which doesn't really feel part of the main drag of the biennial, and they're British artists looking at the Whitney. So Like artists trying to expand the envelope all the time, that the curators are expanding the envelope of what American is? Are they embarrassed at the idea or the fact that they have to work with this definition? Bill, what's your... Why internationalize the American art?
Didn't this come up 4 years ago when they began to expand it beyond national boundaries? And it just... I'm so tired of national boundaries. It seems like, you know, why not? I mean, what's Herzog doing here? Are we being invaded? Bad music, but the images are good.
Yes. Know?
And you know, it doesn't seem to matter very much. I mean, I can imagine some people, maybe artists, maybe dealers or something, feel offended by it. But it doesn't say the Whitney Biennial of American Art, does it?
Well, it's the Whitney Museum of American Art Biennial.
Oh,
so,
yes, right.
You know,
right.
That it there are quite a lot of museums. It's not as if the New York City is an impoverished cultural outpost that doesn't have anything like, say, a MoMA or a Met or a Guggenheim. I mean, we do have the MoMA and the Met and the Guggenheim, which probably do a better job than any other institutions in the world of surveying the world. So why, therefore, subvert the remit of the Whitney and go very tentatively, gingerly, into other spots around the world? Do you have a view on that, Will, why that's happening?
Sure. I think if they're still showing primarily American artists, they're then accurately representing, or they can be fairly considered to be trying to accurately represent what's happening in American art. But to exclude, you know, for example, if you have a collective where one of the guys is Dutch and one of the guys is Greek and the other three are American and they show in America, mm-hmm. That's a part of what's happening in American art. I think, you know, you can be a grant making body and have a citizenship requirement and that has some kind of legal necessity. But if you're in a museum, I think if they fill the place with Dutch people or Greek people or whatever it is, then you would have a problem. But if they're sprinkling around the edges, that's just a more accurate representation of what's actually happening and what the conversation actually is.
Hmm. Yes. I wonder, Karen, if we do stick just for one last moment with this idea of Salon Academy, the Whitney being that, we've had a chance to see there are other events around town. I mean, not that we're short of things to say about the Whitney, but here we have the Academy upstairs. There's the American Arts and Letters, which I always find to be an exhilarating mm-hmm. show. I mean, it's almost... If I had to curate a Whitney Biennial, it wouldn't look all that unlike the American Arts and Letters, I would sometimes feel. Mm-hmm. It's usually about 25-30% of people I'd really want in a show I was organizing. So that's never a ratio, that's never a percentage I've been able to achieve at the Whitney. Now, maybe that just points to the fact that I'm a unredeemable fogey, but do you have a better experience, say here, or the American Arts and Letters, or the Brucennial?
You, not the Brucennial. The Arts and Letters show is always interesting. Now that is artist selected. It's artists choosing artists,
right.
For which there is an old tradition. There were some galleries in New York that used to do that routinely. I think a few are still doing it once in a while. This is the Whitney has always been under the aegis of a small number of people and is somehow more predictable in what you're going to see, much less so than the Arts and Letters, because you've got a changing group of artists who are selecting other artists, usually younger artists, and I find that mix very informative. Mm. It's a smaller show also. It isn't trying to make some vast statement. It's just a narrow slice for this year, and it'll be different next year. There always seems to be some, you know, something terribly large at stake at the Whitney, which it is impossible to fulfill. Now, I can also look back and say, well, I can't remember what year it was, but there was an absolutely spectacularly wonderful Shirin Neshat video, which I still think is the best thing she's ever done. The sound was interfering with one's enjoyment of the Tom Noskowskis that were equally wonderful that were hanging outside of it. But I can hang on to certain works that I really was excited about in other years, and that is not true all the time. I rarely find multiple things in the Whitney that I feel that are memorable or that I'm particularly interested in. But that, you know, I was once described by somebody as a historical modernist, which was not meant as a compliment. But I embrace it. You know, I'm back there in the 20th century. Thank you very much.
Well, what excited you this time?
Sarah Mitchelson's performance was probably the best thing I've seen. I've seen her work before. I was reminded that I should not miss this by one of the New York Times dance critics with whom I go to Pilates class. Oh. And she said, don't miss this. Well, I started out as a dancer, so we have dance talk. And I found it fascinating and exhilarating and exciting, unlike the performance we saw yesterday, which was, to my mind, like misunderstood Merce Cunningham. And that's the most polite thing I can say about it. The Michael Clark performance.
Except it had this pickup crew of people more or less off the street that looked very interesting.
The dancers were pickup dancers, too. I mean, he doesn't have a company.
You mean the ones who were doing...
No, he doesn't have a company.
Yeah.
If he does have a clear idea of what his movement vocabulary is, which I don't think he does, they have not worked with him enough to
have it. Yeah, but there was a distinction between people who were not professional dancers.
Well, they were not professional dancers, and they, you know, the great thing now with modern dance is it doesn't matter what shape you are, whether you can move or not. We don't want to be exclusive about this, you know? The fact that you have a trained body that can actually do something,
Well, if you had that at the Whitney Biennial, then it would clash rather with the painters and sculptors on the other floors.
Sarah Mitchelson's dancers could move.
Yes. But actually, I have to say, I liked Clark's piece, and I'm not a dance aficionado, but I think he was making a very clear distinction between the members of his company who were in black, who were not members of his company, who were recruited, actually, by the Whitney. I actually end up meeting... I was looking at the program on the subway going home, and a lady pointed a finger and said, that's me. And she said there was an open call. You had to write a 300-word essay or less about why you wanted to be in this company.
That's the greatest audition I've ever heard of for a dancer.
Yes. And
Balanchine should have thought of that.
They made a very special point of trying to recruit as many overweight and people as they could. I noticed in the end they put the really chubby fellow in the back row, but
who was having terrible trouble keeping up when they ran.
Yes. That was one of the more interesting things to watch.
But the point is, then there are six members of his company wearing much nicer outfits and pretty nice to look at. Mm-hmm. And, you know, anybody fascist would be happy with at least four of those six dancers.
My quarrel was not with the dancers. They were all very capable. My quarrel is with what he did with them. And I'm not going to go into the whole technical thing, but the basic thing that made me so angry that if I hadn't been sitting in the front row, I would have fled, was the relationship of the movement. This has nothing to do with the performance that was on at the Whitney. This is from something else. The relationship to the music, which... all he was interested in was the rhythm. There was absolutely no inflection, no response to anything tonal. Not that there was much going on tonally in the music. But all he needed was somebody bashing out an absolutely regular beat, which he followed with devastating and boring precision.
Right. Okay. That's true. These are actually just... people rehearsing, they're not, this is not what it looked like.
So you were all lucky to miss it. You feel that way now?
You were lucky to miss it, except they...
Was anybody there?
Anybody here or there? Sarah
Mitchelson?
Was anybody in it?
Anybody here anybody here see the Sarah Mitchelson piece? No.
Oh, as many as that. Okay.
Right. So this does raise, therefore, I mean, Rob, we can, I think, move on and not delve too much into the qualities of performances that no one's seen. But why? What do we think of the Whitney instigating a program that's not going to be seen by? It can only be seen by a tiny handful. It's mm-hmm. it's almost it seems to me a bit like those kind of rich countries that have nationally endowed and supported opera companies that they know only a minute percentage are going to see, but the whole country feels more civilized because it has an opera house. And so
do
it
you
seems
have a problem
be,
with that?
I don't, because I'm part of that tiny percentage that do see it. But although, but it's, is it the Whitney sort of saying, you know, you don't have to see it, just be pleased that there is performance here?
I think it's a larger issue. It's the inclusion of performance itself, and it comes right out of the notion that art is entertainment. And most of the work that is in the biennial, whether it's in the performance category, you know, the specific buy your ticket, it's a limited run performances on the fourth floor, but there is a great deal of video. There's an enormous amount of work that moves, yells at you, jumps up and down. It's a much bigger issue of the fact that sustained looking of something that requires you to bring something to it rather than something that reaches out and does something to you seems to be what is desirable in this biennial.
Well, I think that's a character.
And that's not necessarily entertainment. That's sort of being
sometimes it's
to,
torture.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I don't see how that. I mean, it seems like a contradiction if it's there and you have to bring something to it. Most entertainment comes out and pulls your coat. So, yeah.
But it's.
You know, I'm saying most of the work it does not demand that you. You have to give it some time. It's going to perform for you.
That lack of demand could equally apply to a painting, a static object.
No, you can have a lousy painting as well. But I'm saying that, and lousy sculpture, and.
But you can also have a moving film.
I'm not saying that there isn't wonderful and terrible work in all of these categories.
Yes.
I am saying that there seems to be an assumption that it better sing and dance. There's a sense that you don't, that the artist and the curators do not trust work that isn't doing something extra. For example, I'm forgetting her name now.
Give us a clue.
No, the Jutta.
Jutta. Yes.
The paintings are hung in midair. So that one of them is double-sided, the others you see the back. They are sustained on these very elaborate, I think quite expensive glass screens. And that's so you know, just hang a painting on a wall, that's not enough. I mean, this seems to be built into just about everything.
Well, it seems
in the show.
It was somebody's idea that these were related, like the those photographs, to the Whitney architecture.
Could have fooled me.
That's what the wall takes.
Unlike the art, yeah.
Rich photographs.
I'm sorry. Right,
right.
Or the, you know, who is it? The woman. She has a French name. The woman who did the photographs that are placed like Whitney windows within frames that, you know, that slant like
yes.
that.
In the rhomboids.
And then the silver panel. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Well, the Kutter was supposed to be. I mean, I didn't get it.
Mm-hmm. No, I had to read about that
idea
one too.
About how it was related to the architecture. That was the excuse for mm-hmm.
it. It did seem a fantastically elaborate way to present not fantastically stimulating paintings, which probably would have been less stimulating pinned on the wall, like paintings. But, Will, I think you were going to come in and perhaps take issue with this idea about performance being inherently more entertainment than painting.
Let me see. I was going to come in at a couple of points, so let me pick which yes. At which point I had something. I was going to say that I think the critique Karen is making applies to much of all of the work and all media in the show, but I don't think that's the reason the performance work is included. I mean, I think the reason they include a dance performance that not everyone can see is not to make a tiny sliver of the population, as David said, feel good that it is in the show, but to make the larger sliver of the population that's buying tickets feel as if it's expansive and covering everything. It's part of the performance of being what a biennial is. You know, I thought it was interesting that David pointed out it's more like a festival than a show now. You know, so a festival has to have movies. It has shows, movies. It has dance performances. It has music. It has, you know, it has everything. And it's not. And that in itself has nothing to do with the particular qualities of the pieces being shown for that reason. I think separately, I agree with you that a lot of it needs to dance and entertain, but I think that's just as true of a lot of the painting or the installations. I mean, you look at Nick Mouse's installation, for example, is dancing and trying to entertain. I had a third point, I think, which was that the entertainment, I mean, it's entertaining as art, you know, it's being art, and that's what's entertaining people. So it doesn't have to be pleasant, you know, it can be torturing you, well, because then you think you're seeing art.
I thought that, you know, the idea of covering everything, you know, ends up being, one of the interesting things to me is that it's, it reminds me of the poetry, American poetry, in this way that it's completely splintered in terms of culture. And there's something for everybody in some way, maybe. Yeah. Or at least you can say somebody somewhere will go for this thing. Because there's no, you know, forget unifying aesthetic. Or even, I mean, that, which is maybe to the good. I mean, that may be
realistic.
Maybe that's the statement about, I don't know if it's American culture or just the way culture is. I mean, there's an odd moment in the catalog. You realize you have this catalog that has 6 pages of an interview with the director and about 10 more pages of the curators talking to each other. And which is only interstitially illuminating, but there is a point at which the director of the Whitney says the obligation of the show is to meet institutional and cultural needs. Yeah, I wonder how do you ever determine these needs?
And are they mine, or
are we again? You know. Maybe all of the culture that we have, this is why I think, you know, American doesn't really even matter, is so niched, really
so
tiny.
So atomized. Tiny. Yeah. But the Whitney Biennial is an attempt to be a sort of global overview at global for America.
Well, it didn't used to try to be global. It used to at least, you know.
Well, I don't think it's going that far.
Yeah. I don't mean global in the sense of the whole planet. I mean global in the sense of embracing the whole subject. But I want to dwell more, though, on the definition of performance that's at play here. Because, look, within the art world, there is performance art, and it's done by people who go to art schools and who feel that they're not going to paint this. They're not, on this particular occasion, they're not going to paint or sculpt or make a movie or do an installation. They're going to perform, and some people totally accept that as being an absolutely vital plank of contemporary artistic expression.
It's been going on for the last 35 years.
Exactly. Other people, even though it's been going on for 35 years, other people still complain. Those people can have those debate. But what we have here, interestingly, is something different. I mean, we these are not performance artists. These are dancers, basically. So why? Isn't it actually sort of slightly betraying performance art to say, oh, here's performance and present dance?
I think it's the eternal cliche, the boundaries are permeable these days. Categories are much less important and probably not important at all.
But if they were going to represent dance, if they would say...
They're representing a particular kind of dance, particular artists, particular choreographers. If you read that program from Michael Clark, you would see that 80% of the people who he lists as his backers are visual artists. So he's obviously the darling of that swath of the community. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff going on here.
Does Sarah
Mitchell's question of what dancers you could get to come into a situation like that?
Yes, that's
and also there's probably a question of whether the offer was good enough for them. You know,
exactly. I mean, and there are all kinds of other things.
There are plenty. You know, I was sort of curious that it was. This is a British choreographer, right? So we've got that porousness. But you know, I was thinking of all kinds of people who are in New York who might qualify for that kind of space. But like, you know, Douglas Dunn or Yoshiko in the School of Hard Knocks or all kinds of people around dance space. But then again, you know,
but
would they want to?
Sarah Mitchelson, does she, do we think she would say, wow, I'm happy to perform anywhere. They want me. That's great. Or do you think she'd think, yes, this makes sense. I'm a visual artist, and I should be here.
The piece also started with a voiceover, and ended with a voiceover. The first part was a conversation with someone who is also going to be performing later with a theater piece. So it may have been a case of getting two for the price of one. I don't know. But she tends to be, from what I've seen, she tends to be interested in collaborating with visual artists. As I say, it's, you know, it's a much looser fit. I mean, what 30 years ago, wouldn't it have been interesting to have had Merce Cunningham and John Cage, with probably Rauschenberg playing a part in it as well? And that was always an integral part of those performances, is that relationship of the music and the visual art component. So Martha Graham and Noguchi, you know.
And so the film component as well, is that's are we dealing, there are visual artists, and there have been for a very long time now, who are working within the remit of the art world, within art world kind of art, using the moving image, video, other mediums of moving film. But we have enlisted here, don't we, people who are within the filmmaking world. I mean, maybe I'm just being idiotic in insisting on these categories. But maybe, in fact, actually, it would be very much holding up a torch to video artists to demand that their work is seen not in the context of art and compared with painting, but seen in the context of movies and compared to whatever comes out of Hollywood.
You know. Different depth of field.
Different depth of field. But why have the curators, are the curators doing something provocative and powerful and useful by bringing in filmmakers like, for instance, Nathaniel Dorsky, or is it actually just confusing categories?
No, it's been there longer than video's been there. You know, film has been in part of these shows, maybe not the Whitney, but certainly at Museum of Modern Art and other places in New York and elsewhere. You know, but at this point, it seems to be for one reason, it's a good idea because there's this predominant gallery film scene, which, at least to my eyes, I almost every time I see something proposing to be film in an art gallery, I think, wait a minute, that filmmaker could use a little course in filmmaking from the filmmakers who have been working for the last 40 years or more, like Dorsky or Stan Brakhage or Mike Kuchar or George Kuchar and others, you know?
Right.
So, you know, these films of Hylers and Dorsky and Kuchar and so forth show at the Anthology Film Archives, at the New York Film Festival, et cetera, you know, this is just within New York. But they don't ordinarily get shown in the Whitney. I don't know why that's been. Maybe, you know, those particular people are new to the Whitney Biennial.
I mean,
you know,
simply
I know that Karen said she didn't like the Dorsky films, but you know, to my mind, it's a good thing that they get shown.
Right, but it's an inefficient way to show, say, dance on the fourth floor of the Whitney, where the dance space is sort of like bigger than the stage of the Metropolitan Opera House, and the audience space would be a disappointment at the review panel. You could get less people than are here for the review panel could actually see the dance. Something's screwed up there, and just in terms of logistics, if you decide, if you decide to do a Whitney biennial...
We've seen Cunningham and other companies mm-hmm. use spaces like that, and even larger spaces, mm-hmm. than that. The fact that this particular company or whatever it is couldn't fill it spiritually is another matter, or aesthetically is another matter.
But if the Whitney wants to say we are the festival of the American culture and all its manifestations, it could simply, as the Modern has done, go and find a good movie house somewhere in town and say this is part of the Whitney, and go
well,
to
they
the
only
Joyce
did,
and
they
say,
only did
this
that
is part
when
of the Whitney.
Their own theater was being renovated. Okay. But the Modern, it's interesting that you're bringing up the Modern, because as you know, during the last drawing show, they had somebody writhing on the floor of the atrium that was supposed to be a drawing, and that apparently was so well received that he's coming back to do more of it this summer.
He drew a crowd.
And they're deciding to turn the atrium into a space for
writhing.
Dance.
Right.
So, you know, this is clearly the flavor. This is clearly the flavor of the month. You know,
yes, the Agnes Gund writhing,
and they're doing a marathon of Kraftwerk,
right? Well,
you know, which is
listen,
also noisy.
Can we get off the institution? We don't want to do their job, and you know, I sort of think, okay, let them do their job. That maybe they're doing the best they can with what they've got. You know, I mean. Isn't there something about the artists that we can say that I think the only problem in this whole business is that it's a business for one thing, and everything's so damn professionalized, and part of what is professionalized is this thing called, and the catalog is full of it, called the discourse, but none of that is the artist's fault.
Right.
Well, in one case it is, because there is one artist...
Only if they swallow it.
No. There is one artist, Andrea Fraser's work of art...
Yes, well, that is the
...which is listed as dimensions variable, is in fact a chapter of the catalog, which demonstrates, we are told, her long-standing engagement with art discourse.
Right.
So
that's
all
she
does.
What I mean,
she types.
A certain contagion, but I think that there's...
I loved the dimensions variable part. That was what really got to me.
That's why it doesn't matter how much space you have for the dance performance. Also, you're not...
Excellent.
The dance is not actually being performed. It's like part of the DJ culture. You know, you're saying, here is Nick Mouse's, here's a Charles DeMuth watercolor. Mm-hmm. You don't have to actually be able to look at it. You mm-hmm. just have to know what it is. And mm-hmm. my work of art is reminding you of the existence of that thing, which mm-hmm. I've chosen to remind you of. And so the dance, you know, they could do the dance on the roof. It doesn't make it without anybody watching if it's listed
in
the catalog.
Well, what happens when you see the thing, though? I mean, that is to say, the Demuth looks... That Kelly is...
Well,
one of,
I would prefer
one,
to look
that,
at the...
That Ellsworth Kelly drawing is one of the most terrific drawings, period, as well as one of the great Kelly drawings.
Oh, yeah, me...
So you're
yeah.
grateful to see it.
Yeah, yeah.
And
no,
it's
me personally, I would rather...
It's
another form of collage.
Once I see it,
yeah.
I stop thinking about Nick Mouse.
I agree
except,
completely.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
You could argue that the best painting at the Whitney is the... And argue very convincingly the best painting in the biennial is the Mars and Hartley.
Yes. But then we should be grateful to Mouse for having the good taste to make that his work. It's a form of discourse, certainly, and of certain form of...
We don't have to agree that it's
ego abnegation.
His work. I mean, we can be glad that he chose that without crediting him with an achievement mm-hmm. equal to Mars
and
Hartley.
I'm not sure, really,
because I
take issue. Because, I mean, if you're a painter, if you're a collagist, and there is that guy, Hawkins... We actually saw in our presentation some paintings, but more striking actually were the collages, odd little things, really more like scrapbooks than they had no kind of visual, they had no gestalt, but they were colored paper with some cut out Francis Bacon and this one and that one pasted up. Now, so isn't, in a way, Mouse just doing something like that. This is
collage as
installation.
Oh, in principle, he is. I just personally don't think he's doing it as well as Hawkins. It's, you know,
he's not doing it as well. No. But
you like those things?
You
like the Hawkins thing?
Well, Hawkins,
as collages, they're, you know.
The collages are appalling. I mean, I think I prefer the mouse. The mouse, I mean, he's a... You usually say somebody's a mouse compared to a cat, but what would Yes, this is a flea compared to a mouse with the Hawkins collages. They just don't work at all. The paintings weren't
They're based on, as I understand it, they're based on the scrapbooks of the inventor of, or the instigator of Butoh dance in Japan.
Oh, you've done some homework. I didn't gather that.
Well, that makes a huge difference.
I'm transformed. I take back everything I said about Mr. Hawkins' scrapbook.
Has Mr. Hawkins been lowered from a building? Has Mr. Hawkins himself been lowered upside down from a building wearing nothing but gray makeup?
You read about it.
Am I the only one who read the wall text?
At a certain point, you need danger pay.
It's all about erotic transgression.
Oh, good. We like that.
Yes. This obviously sounds incredibly naive, but wouldn't you think erotic transgression might be visible in the thing itself rather than having to read about it?
I try not to think about it.
That sounds like a very serious transgression of the erotic if you have to read about it in a wall text. But what about Mr. Gober making his work, as it were, a curation? I mean, Gober already proved himself to be a very capable curator, I thought, in a superb exhibition of Charles Birchfield last year. And it reminded me a little bit of the way in, say, the Salon d'Antan, you had a little retrospective of or memorial to Cézanne in the turn of the century.
It wasn't so little,
but it was a show within the show, as it were. So a picture within the picture. Is Gober saying, okay, is Gober saying, well, first of all, presumably, you know, artists who are selected for the biennial don't choose what they're going to do. A piece by them is chosen by the curators. So one wonders how it happens, therefore, that the curators, including Gober, end up with a Forest Best show. Did the curators decide they wanted a Forest Best show and Gober would curate it? Or was it that the curators wanted a Gober and Gober said, you're getting a Forest Best show?
I don't know the answer to that, but I think your assumption that pieces are chosen is not entirely accurate. I think the artists are chosen, possibly from other pieces, but many of the things that are there were conceived for this exhibition.
So it's more of a spectacle, again, more of a festival than an exhibition. Well,
what about Bess?
What about Bess? Let's talk about Bess.
I'm grateful to see those paintings. I wish they would deal less with the other parts of him.
Parts being the operative word here. This, in case anyone's wondering what this allusion is to, Gober chose to foreground the personal experiment, what Forrest Best considered his scientific work, which was a form of self-mutilation,
he wanted Betty Parsons to exhibit, and she refused.
Right. It's a little too early who was that guy? Oh, never mind. It had to wait for another chapter of performance art for the art world to understand and accept that self-mutilation is indeed as valid a form of art as painting. But Betty Parsons was too early for that, but was very advanced in what she did do. So why then? What did you make of the Bess? What does its presence really bring?
Let me say first. I want to say that if it is the case that they pick the artist rather than the piece, and the artist comes up with what to put, then I think it is the right thing to give him what was apparently his fervent wish, which was to have his medical treatise displayed next to his painting. I mean, in the artist's mind, according to what I read, he was a guy who we would call an outsider artist, despite having shown in New York, I think, mm-hmm. in part because he was mentally ill and conceived of what he was doing as transcribing visions he had rather than composing paintings in the way that most of the other mm-hmm. people painting in the show would be doing. So I think it's appropriate to honor his intention in that way, even if it's kind of gruesome and unpleasant, which it certainly was.
I think we have the option
not to look, as many people. You know,
but an awful lot of people were not looking at the paintings and were hunched over the display case.
Well, that's
right.
The option,
well, but
too.
That's a free choice. I mean, I would rather look at the paintings, but yeah.
I mean, imagine if paintings weren't crowded, you could look at them with great ease, which was fine.
You could.
But it's appropriating.
You looked at those paintings with great ease.
Well, there was no one standing in your way.
Just the physical logistical sense.
I mean, I don't find them, you know.
No, they're
comfortable.
No. I simply meant that when the times I've been there, it was impossible to see the photograph in the display case, mm-hmm. but you had no trouble spending time with each of the paintings.
Right.
But presumably Gober would want to say, look, Frois Bess's paintings are sublime, they're transformative, they're transcendent, but we need to respect Bess on his own terms. And as Will says, this is an opportunity to say this was as important to Bess as paint. Bess wasn't trying to be Arthur Dove. Bess was... believed himself to be a transcriber of visions and believed mm-hmm. his scientific research into this mystical research as being as valid or more as important as the production of fine artworks. So Gober is sort of enlisting Bess, isn't he, to say art is about more than pretty objects.
I wouldn't call those pretty. I've got to play devil's advocate here. Isn't the curator's role to make decisions? So the decision to include something or to exclude something is mm-hmm. equally significant.
So when we have Bess's scientific work that you don't like, is that an aesthetic decision by Gober, or is that a curatorial decision by, beyond Gober, the curators of the Whitney Biennial? What are we looking at when we look at Bess? Are we looking at Bess or are we looking at Gober? That's my question, really. Because Bess is dead.
I think Gober stepped aside quite mm-hmm. nicely. And anyway, it's not scientific. The guy was trying to bring out the woman that he felt. I mean, it was like one of those things where you're trying to what is that term? You're trying to bring the masculine and the feminine together, the masculine and feminine of your psyche together.
He wanted to embody it. Yes.
He wasn't doing scientific research.
No.
He was trying to get himself together as he saw it, you know.
Yes.
Get yourself together, Forrest. And so he did. He botched the job. And so then you have something that people can say, well, I don't know if I want to look at that because it's sort of gruesome because it's a botched job. But, you know.
He did send his notes to the president and as scientific
right.
research.
Oh,
that's
okay.
That's the
what
I gathered.
Mm-hmm.
The panel isn't buying my question. Look.
I think your question
is trying to put the curators back in the picture, and I'm trying to get the curators out of the picture.
Okay, but I let's keep the curators out of the picture and put Gober into the picture. Gober is a living artist. He's participating in the biennial curatorially and presenting a room of Frois Bess and presenting two sides of Frois Bess, the painter and the castrator, as...
He didn't castrate himself.
Or, the mutilator, the experimenter,
don't have to look it up.
He is presenting. Gober is present as a living artist in this work, right?
No, he simply chose them, and frankly, I'm delighted he did, because if I were confronted by a room full of Gobers, I would have been much less interested than a room full of Frois Besses. So, from a purely selfish point of view.
Yes.
I don't care. I'm just glad they're there.
Good. Okay, I think we're all glad some of it is there. So tell me, Bill, you're going to go back to San Francisco and shut your eyes on the plane. Which artist is going to pop into your mind from the 2012 Whitney Biennial? Who is the most memorable aesthetic experience you had thanks to this trip?
This one doesn't qualify, but the one called Tom Thayer is very interesting to me because I walked into the room and I said, this is pretty much what they were after. Mm-hmm. And that is to say, it seemed real raw and had all these aspects to it of, you know, relics of performances, parts of animation, all this kind of stuff, and it was like sort of dirty and down, you know, and I just so instinctively and against my better judgment, I liked it.
Right.
You know? And so that's memorable to me because I was interested in that was instantaneous. And I didn't have to think about it when I went back to it today. It seemed like the same thing, and the it's odd that the photograph here makes it look so bright and sweet and clean, and it's not. I mean, it's sweet, yes.
You know. The birds, the twittering birds.
But I mean, this is not what it looks like.
It's not what it feels
it's
like.
Dark
yes.
And messy.
And dark
visceral,
and messy
yes.
And, and yeah, dirty. And it seemed like, yeah. So that's memorable to me. It was interesting because I did wonder yesterday, is there anything memorable? Yeah, the best has got more memorable as time went by. And, somebody we didn't talk about, Cameron
Crawford.
Do we have him, Cameron Crawford?
Yeah, I was very interested. Yeah, you didn't show images.
That was
images.
Very interesting. That's
you didn't,
an interesting
he was on
thing.
My
he
list.
Said,
you
he
didn't
said
have
that
images.
Thing about useless labor, which used to be a banner headline for modernist art, or at least, I don't know about the labor part, but useless. You know, one thing that was supposed to be great about modern art was that it was blatantly useless against a functional society, right? Mm-hmm. You could be an artist and you could make something that didn't have any use. Right? That was I thought that was a terrific idea when I was a teenager, you know, and a little later too, you know, because everything was because they used to have panel discussions like this and say, what is the function of art?
The role of the artist in society today.
Yeah. And they said, forget it.
I don't think you
that's
showed
none
him.
At all. So the, so here's a 28-year-old
he was on
who thought it up on his own. And it's a sign of an interesting disconnect. There are all kinds of amnesiac replays or naive replays of slogans of modernism in this show. If you look at these wall texts and you read through the catalog, and I think a lot of it is just some aspects of modern art that are instinctive or became instinctive that nobody ever read about. And they come back around, and so there were these two very nice looking constructions that this guy made with this idea that he wanted to make something that was probably fairly labor intensive. Though the second piece, the upright piece, wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
So,
oh yes,
yeah, seemed very easy to make.
They had strangely double titles: Making Water Storage Revolution,
Water Storage
Revolution.
Right. Yeah.
Yes.
Which
well,
means
if you read that wall text, you know that those hinges were handmade.
Yeah.
And they don't function.
Yeah,
so there's your labor. There's
too,
your labor intensive
the,
part.
The,
yeah.
The curtain.
No, they were kind of appealing.
Would they be what you would nominate, Karen, as the most? I mean, you mentioned your enthusiasm for Sarah Mitchelson, but among
and Hartley.
and Marston Hartley.
Yeah.
Great. But is there? A single artist who really stands out in your mind as somebody you're going to want to investigate further as a result of discovering here at the Biennial? That's
hard to say because, I mean, I knew Anthony Masullo's work before seeing it there.
Okay, well, let's talk
and,
about him.
I thought the small paintings were much more inventive than the large paintings. There seems to be this... Bill's really hit it when he talks about this kind of aesthetic amnesia because there's all of this text which tells you that he starts out putting something on the canvas and he goes from there.
How revolutionary,
you know.
Who would ever have thought of doing that as a way of creating an image?
I mean, he's very much part of a whole aesthetic, which in fact... Forrest Best fits into as well.
Yes.
Personally, I prefer Tom Nuskalski, who I find a resonant and ambiguous and extraordinary artist. There's none of the kind of subtlety of the use of material here, but he seems to be after something that I can take seriously.
His aesthetic seems to be much more closely aligned to Mary Heilman.
Yeah, Mary Heilman, Laurie Fendrick. I mean, you know, there are a lot of people out there that are working in this way. And
South Park.
Yes, yes. It's more cartoony than Mary Heilman.
What did you make of Masullo, Will?
I really liked Masullo a lot because I don't think the naive recycling of modernist ideas is because they've never read anything and came to it independently. I think it's because we're still involved in kind of purging that from the system. Hmm. And
you want to purge it?
Do I personally want to? I think that's the way it's... I would rather purge it than have it hang around half-digested and poisonously. I mean... I like the
You mean that way, purge.
Yeah, I don't mean with blood in the streets. No. Probably depends how it goes, I guess. But what I like so much about the Masullo paintings is that they, as compared with everything, most of the other work in the show, Tom Thayer's work, for example, or the Richard Hawkins collages, which I liked because he's actually they're doing something as compared to the more sterile kind of DJ culture installation, which I would put Mouse under. It's actually struggling to make something, or Don Casper again, who had the installation.
Oh, right.
I'm not going to argue that it's an interesting idea, but it was a relief to me to come around a corner and see a pile of her stuff in the room because it's actually real stuff. You know, it's not recycled secondhand ideas. But all of that said, what I like so much about Masullo and Forrest Best is that you can look at one of his paintings, and obviously it has a context and a tradition it's coming out of, but you can look at one of them and it works on its own terms. You know, you don't need to refer to the tradition to get something from the painting. I need to have some...
Or the wall text.
Right. I didn't read the wall text. I think, you know, you can just look at the painting and... believe and relate to its compositional and chromatic problems that it's dealing with on its own terms, and it's a self-contained kind of object. So I like that. I also like the candy colors, but that's a
yes.
personal preference.
I had a very similar reaction to Tom Thayer, to Bill's. It was kind of appealing, and you know, it pushed all the right buttons. And the individual works were sometimes interesting, but there was this very, very modish, random, carefully calculated random installation, which seemed very much of the moment. I mean, there's a lot of that going on.
Yes, I found what's her name? The woman who she's blanking on her name now, who had her whole setup, her whole room,
Don Casper.
I found Don Casper profoundly intrusive on the rest of that floor. One had whatever
was
records
she was playing.
Was she playing
her very, very loud
she
music?
She was playing loud, bad music that her friends were choosing for her.
Yeah.
And that really sort of poured like a syrup over, or a soup over the experience of everything else one was trying to see. But there are a number of artists I thought were pretty strong and remarkable as individuals, although it seemed to me that there are artists I've liked in the past who've done good work that I've really responded to, and the Whitney curators seem to find their least persuasive work that they could. Nicole Eisenman and Latoya Wilcox both fall into
I thought she was interesting.
But they were interesting enough, certainly. I've seen stronger, but they were certainly powerful and persuasive pieces. Can we talk about those, what they were doing, those two artists? Tell us what you found rich and powerful about Fraser's work, Karen.
Well, some of them, I think, are very much in a very clear documentary tradition. I think it probably would have made a better book than an exhibition. But she's I think, visually very acute. She's playing with that tradition and tailoring it to a very specific situation that she's clearly very familiar with, this attempt to keep a hospital in her community from closing. And then this series, though, reminded me very much of Francesca Woodman. And I don't know how familiar she is with Francesca Woodman.
Also Carrie Mae Weems.
Also Richard Billingham, the British artist, although more in her earlier work that really explored her mother as a subject, her alcoholic mother in her deprived space.
Her images I've responded to them initially as images, and then the narrative kicks in, and I find her very convincing.
Yes, I found that she also, despite some reservations, the hospital series transcended the kind of agitprop documentary aspect, in also the quite rare. There's so much work in the biennial that brings text and image together. Actually, the visual sensibility of text presentation seemed to be quite striking.
Well, the text seemed to and the images really work together in an extremely useful way. It wasn't a kind of gratuitous commentary.
Yes, but much as the way that the images document, the text is actually inherently visual.
The way she wrote it.
The way she wrote it.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yes. Will, was there an artist in the show that's going to tempt you to look further at his or her work, or was there somebody you've followed with great interest and were delighted to see here?
Oh, well, I thought we hit that. I would say Masullo.
Masullo, right.
Masullo, Forrest Bess. Forrest Bess's work I didn't know, and I don't know how much occasion I have to go see more of it, but...
I think you're going to be seeing a lot of it from now on.
Oh, right. Well, I hope that isn't a process of disillusionment.
Isn't there a separate show at Christie's right now?
Yes.
Right. Yeah. There are only 100 paintings, from what I understand.
Oh, okay. How many are in this room at the Whitney? Must have been 8 or 10.
8 or 10, yeah.
Is it just that?
Is it only that few?
Not a lot.
Right. I suppose the display case has made it feel like a larger installation.
Yeah, it's quite sparse.
It's a whole. Yes.